If your nostrils were positioned like those of a dolphin, you'd blow your nose from the top of your forehead. Pachycetus, Myocetus, and Remingtonocetus had nostrils towards the tip of their snout. And these structures slowly migrated backward in other stages of fossil whales, up to the bottlenose dolphins that we see today, with nostrils displaced well behind the eyes. Interestingly, whales aren't alone in nostril migration. Sea cows and manatees, also full-time aquatic mammals, have nostrils positioned high on the skull, though not behind the eyes, whereas their early fossil relatives have nostrils positioned more forward. This parallel migration of the nostrils lets fully aquatic mammals, such as whales and sea cows, orient their body in a more energy-saving horizontal position in the water, as opposed to doggy paddling with their nose out of the water. But swimming horizontally is just part of the reason for the strangeness of the bottlenose dolphin skull before us. When viewed from the side, the top of a bottlenose dolphin skull is shaped like a scoop. If you were a dolphin, imagine having a skull with a dish-like forehead right above your eyebrows. In life, for a dolphin, this cavity contains a cone of fat called the melon, which gives toothed whales a dome-like forehead. Tucked behind the melon and underneath the blowhole are empty sacs, air sinuses underlain by muscles and sealed with an organ that looks like a pair of lips. When these lips buzz like a trumpeter's, they generate sound, which bounces around inside of the head and then gets focused by the melon into a discrete path out of the head as a high-frequency sound beam, like an acoustic beam emanating from a searchlight strapped to the dolphin's forehead. By coordinating this process across a specialized set of anatomical parts to generate sound, toothed whales create a form of biological sonar, or echolocate, to see their underwater world in sound. All toothed whale species alive today echolocate, whether they are sperm whales, beaked whales, river dolphins, porpoises, or true dolphins. It's how they wayfind or hunt in murky rivers or at ocean depth, sometimes a mile deep with no light. Echolocation itself has evolved only a handful of times in other vertebrates. Toothed whales are the only animals that do it underwater. Making high-frequency sound, however, is just one part of echolocation. After sound bounces off an object, it produces an echo that the animal needs to hear. The classic dolphin chirps and squeaks are how they vocalize to communicate with one another at lower frequencies. We can't hear directionally underwater, but whales can because their ear bones float inside hollow pockets. In life, the ear bones of a dolphin hang in a sinus cavity full of spongy tissue, which acoustically isolates each ear, letting the brain detect small differences in the arrival time of sound between the right and left ear, helping to pinpoint the source in three dimensions. Whales have had the ability to hear like this since the time of Ambulocetus. But how does sound get to the ear bones, especially when whales don't have external ears? Fats are conductive of sound, and along with the melon, toothed whales have large fat bodies that fit hand in glove into hollows in the back of their jaws and then branch out, backward, into lobes that directly connect to the ear bones. Akin to the way our ear canals funnel sound, these fat bodies provide a pathway for sound to reach the ears, although researchers still debate whether there aren't other acoustic pathways in the head. Testing the anatomical basis for echolocation requires clever experimental work, and captive animals are not easily procured. This hallmark sense in toothed whales was poorly understood until the late 1950s, when scientists, supported by strong interest from the U.S. Navy, resolved the enigmatic echolocation abilities of toothed whales in a simple way. After covering a captive dolphin's eyes with suction cups, they discovered that the animal was still able to navigate a maze to find a small object. We still know little about how echolocation in toothed whales truly works, especially in wild, free-ranging animals. It surpasses even the best military technology, and we're just starting to understand the basics. There is marked variation from species to species in terms of the arrangement of air sacs, melon shape, and even ear bones. What any one of those differences means for sound frequency and how whales perceive it remains a broad mystery, hopefully the work of future dissertations. We can say, however, that a quick tour of a dolphin skull shows us how evolution refashions or modifies existing parts, like nostrils displaced behind the levels of the eyes, while other times it generates completely new structures, such as a biosonar apparatus on the forehead. How evolutionary novelty happens remains one of the most important unanswered questions in biology today. Transformation and novelty are recurring themes in whale evolution, as much as they are for any group in the tree of life, and it is sometimes difficult to parse the distinction between them. Consider how the feathers that most birds use today for flight are elaborations, transformed many, many times over, from basic scales that once covered their dinosaur ancestors. Or how turtles, early in their evolutionary history, acquired shoulder blades inside their ribcage. Turtles' ribs later fused with other bones, so that every turtle thereafter, for the past 200 million years, has had a shell with its shoulders tucked firmly inside. In both of these cases, evolutionary novelty does come from somewhere in the body. It's an extreme flavor of transformation that starts with some available parts. But novelty is different because of its consequences. Whereas a transformation can be the reduction of parts or a change in size or proportions, a novelty is a one-time evolutionary appearance of a new structure that enables the evolutionary success of all of its descendants. Today's whales are exemplars of the great success of evolutionary novelty, with echolocation in toothed whales and filter feeding in baleen whales, enabled by biological apparatuses present in none of their forebears. Evolution is the intellectual glue that connects living whales in all of their seeming weirdness to their deep ancestry, which is both incomplete and still not entirely known. Skulls point us to these evolutionary clues in a tangible and clear way. And without these insights, and the millions of years that brought these changes about, it would be very hard to illuminate the connection whales have with other closely related mammals. My way back to whales, as a scientist, has always involved skulls in one way or another. In college, I puzzled over a half-rotten dolphin head when our field class, on a barrier island off the coast of Georgia, discovered its carcass buried in the sand. The putrid smell dispersed the rest of the class, but I held fast. I wasn't riveted by the grotesque allure. Instead, I was captivated for the first time by the thought of how, exactly, a whale might become a fossil. In graduate school, I sought fossil whale skulls peeking out of seaside cliffs or crumbling out of rock formations in badlands that were once seafloors. Cetaceans became my vehicles for understanding life over geologic time, across scales so vast that we cannot truly comprehend them, even if paleontologists casually discuss geologic markers as if referring to last week's dentist appointment. And it all led me to the Smithsonian, where I tend to the world's great collection of fossil whale skulls. However, part of the deal with being a museum scientist, especially at the Smithsonian, is that people ask you for tours. It's more than a fair trade. First, I like giving tours. They give me an excuse to try out new ways to talk about ideas, the big ones, like the evidence for evolution and extinction, that not only excite me but also explain how whales came to be. Also, tours often involve children, and children are usually the toughest audiences of all, whether they're whale huggers or fossil fiends. If I can figure out how to keep them interested, even for a short show and tell, then I think I've done my job. And who knows? I might be convincing enough to ignite more than a passing interest. My friend and colleague Megan McKenna first taught me about whale heads and their inner biosonar anatomy when we were both in graduate school. So when she brought her family recently for an early morning tour before the museum opened, I was excited at the opportunity to settle a debt. Her 4-year-old daughter was just a bit older than mine. The museum's halls, especially when they're empty, can be intimidating spaces. So I started slowly. I didn't want to overwhelm or manufacture too much excitement. As we walked into the Sainte Ocean Hall, we stopped short underneath the imposing right whale model and turned to face the eel-like skeleton of Basilosaurus, grimacing from above. Basilosaurus is an early whale several million years younger than Pachycetus and Miocetus, but it looks worlds apart in size and shape. Its dinosaur-sounding name literally translates from Latin as king lizard, in a nod to its serpentine, bust-length body. The first fossils of Basilosaurus were collected from the chalky marls of rural Arkansas and Alabama in the early 19th century. With a skull over 3 feet long, jaws bearing palm-sized, saw-shaped teeth, and individual vertebrae large enough to serve as stools, a Basilosaurus skeleton gives every impression of belonging to a sea monster. And its name has stuck, if only for the conventions that scientists use to name species. Unlike today's whales, Basilosaurus has a head that does not dominate its body, arms that crook at the elbows, and a surprising, diminutive set of legs that could never have supported its large weight on land. But Basilosaurus has an involucrum, like all the other early land-dwelling whales, and its ear bones floated in a sinus space below its skull. Basilosaurus did not echolocate, nor filter feed, leaving it caught somewhat in an evolutionary middle ground for whale evolution. One of the first fully aquatic whales, completely unreliant on land, yet still carrying many of the biological apparatuses of its terrestrial ancestors. As I walked with Megan under the skeleton, I pointed to its hind limbs and joked aloud about how they dangled like poorly placed miniature landing gear. Megan then leaned down to her daughter. "Hey, Etta, Nick studies whale bones just like those ones." Etta looked at me intently, mulling the assertion. "Why?" I opened my mouth to deliver a canned response involving school, science, and curiosity, more boilerplate than authentic. I knew I could do better. I waited a few beats. "Their bones all tell stories," I said, "about where whales came from." She glanced up at Basilosaurus, looming from the ceiling, like a giant, flippered, macabre snake. "And if you want to become a scientist, you can learn to read them and know their stories." I knew I had her attention. "But they sure don't just show up here in a museum all put together," I smiled. "You have to find them first." Chapter 3, The Stories Bones Tell. I walked with my eyes trained on a long gray road cut through a hillside on a cattle ranch. In the late afternoon California sun, the waving golden grass gave the hill the look of an enormous, shaggy animal revealing its sedimentary flank. I followed a small path parallel to the exposed fossil-rich layer. Walk, stare, walk some more, scrape the exposure, then walk again. Maybe you get lucky. A few yards away from me, my colleague Jim Parham was doing the exact same thing. I've known Jim since graduate school, and we don't need to say much to each other in the field. Jim's an expert on turtles and other reptiles. As it is for me with whale bones, Jim has seen enough specimens that even the smallest fragments of fossil shell can help him solve riddles about turtle origins, which stretch back even deeper in geologic time than whales, though we tend to find fossil sea turtles in the same type of rock as fossil whales. Jim and I reliably fall on the same page, by temperament and by rock units. We had visited many other outcrops in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada together. We worked side by side, scanning in silence. "Hey," Jim said abruptly, reaching down. He raised a palm-sized shark tooth to the sky, its serrated edges cutting the orange light. I looked down and immediately started to see other shark teeth and whalebone fragments recently eroded out of the hillside, gems in the rough. "Ooh, check this out," I said, retrieving a segment of dolphin rib from the newly formed sediment piles. As I flipped it over between my fingers, I noticed something unusual. A set of a dozen parallel lines gouging a path across the bone's surface. A shark bite. This site was, after all, the Sharktooth Hill bone bed. The fact that the rib bone belonged to a small species of extinct tooth whale, Odontocete indeterminate, if you want to be technical, was probably the least interesting thing about it. That kind of identification is merely born out of the same patient study, ours with museum collections, that gives you eyes for spotting bones in the first place. Far more interesting was the fact that it told us part of a story. A little more than 15 million years ago, in the middle of the Miocene, an ancient shark chomped down on an extinct dolphin's ribcage. Whether this particular set of bones represented a fatal encounter or mere scavenging on a carcass, we couldn't know. There was also no real way of knowing whether the shark tooth in Jim's hand and the marked rib in mine were causally related. We held the two side by side, checking the serrations on the tooth with the gouges on the rib. Close, but not a precise match. Even if they were, it would be a stretch to tie the two pieces of evidence, a gumshoe's leap in causality, at a suspected murder scene. Whale bones do tell us stories, but they're not always satisfying or predictable. I lodge finds like these on the shelves of whale bones that I keep in my head. I can't tell you how this mental library is organized, but I slip into it every time I see a shard or a glint of whale bone, whether out in the field or in a museum drawer. The more fragmentary, the more fun. I pick it up carefully, thumb its creases, divots, and twists, and then scrutinize its topography by eye. My thoughts immediately race through a chain of mental flashcards to arrive at the best possible identification of its former owner. Right or left side? Symmetrical from the main axis of the skeleton? Cranial or something below the neck? Scavenging marks? Pathologies? These flashcards are marked with names for every bump and hole on a bone's surface. It has taken me years to build up this cerebral collection, long hours spent with many skeletons within arm's reach, flipping each piece over and over again, tracing each surface from memory. It's also good to keep a stack of real literature on hand as a guide, because you certainly aren't the first one to pick up a whalebone and ask it a question. How did you get here? Where in the skeleton do you belong? What happened to your owner? There's an undeniable thrill in this chase, whether it's in the field or in a museum collection. And fortunately, you carry your mental library everywhere you go. Anyone can participate, too. Amateur sleuths sometimes crack cold cases. There is, however, a catch. You hardly ever get all the answers. As with other vertebrates, the fossilized skeletons of whales tend to be massively incomplete because the organismal glue that keeps skeletons together, stuff like ligaments, fibers, cartilage, and muscle, decays rapidly and is dispersed by waves, scavengers, and time. Our knowledge of most fossil whale species is based on little more than a battered skull, lacking all but the most diagnostic and unique features. For some time periods, and in some parts of the world, we can put all of what we know about the whale fossil record on one table. These fragments of bones, skulls, teeth, vertebrae, limb bones, can look like a jumbled puzzle waiting for someone to bring the missing pieces. Or, preferably, the cover of the box. This situation is what we tend to find for most fossil whales from the first phase of their evolutionary history, the part that took place at least partially on land. We don't have complete skeletons for Pachycetus, Ambulocetus, Remingtonocetus, or most of the close relatives of Miocetus. Being aquatic clearly helps in getting preserved intact. Perhaps the size increase from Miocetus to much larger early whales, such as Basilosaurus, is part of why we tend to find more complete skeletons belonging to fully aquatic whales. While the bones individually get larger, they are fewer in number when you reduce and eliminate paired leg and foot bones. The fact is we don't have a good understanding of the intermediary steps between hind limb-propelled whales to tail-propelled ones. For all the anatomical transformations that happened in the earliest whales, there is a gap in the fossil record and our understanding between the last semi-aquatic and the first fully aquatic whales. To fill out the picture, we need more fieldwork in the right places with rocks of the right age and a lot of luck. A good paleontologist can go far on scraps alone, and sometimes we're lucky. There are places, or times, because paleontologists think in both space and time, where the fossil record yields parts of hundreds and even thousands of individuals. These fossil-rich areas are called bone beds. My mental library comes in handy when I encounter one, helping me distinguish a scrap as the bone of a whale versus that of any other animal. At their densest, fossil whales and bone beds get jumbled with scraps of other extinct marine mammals, seabirds, sea turtles, and sharks into layers only a few inches thick. At the other end of the spectrum, complete whale skeletons can be distributed over a broad area that can even reach square miles. The definition of a bone bed has mostly to do with the fact that skeletal parts are concentrated within a single layer of rock. What paleontologists and geologists want to know once they've found a bone bed is how much geologic time has compressed the evidence, which can represent as much as a million years or maybe just a day's worth of a flood. In the 1920s, one of my predecessors at this Smithsonian, Remington Kellogg, recognized that the Sharktooth Hill bone bed in the foothills of the Central Valley contained a richness of fossil whales, mostly identified on the basis of broken skulls and individual ear bones. The bones that form the outer, middle, and inner ears of whales are among the most heavily mineralized bones for any mammal, all the better for hearing underwater and for preservation in the geologic record. The acoustically isolated ear bones discussed previously in bottlenose dolphins can also be found back to the time of the Sharktooth Hill bone bed and beyond to the age of Pakicetus. Kellogg described and named 12 previously unknown fossil whale species from the Sharktooth Hill bone bed, encompassing a range of extinct baleen whales, early sperm whales, oceanic dolphins, and distant relatives of river dolphins. At this point in whale evolution, the world was full of filter-feeding and echolocating whales. All the land-dwelling ones were long extinct, but they lived alongside sea cows, strange hippo-like herbivores called desmostylians, early seals, and early walruses. The material record of that past world comes from the Sharktooth Hill bone bed, which is an orange and brown layer only a few inches thick, chock full of bone bits spread over a dozen or so square miles northeast of Bakersfield. Jim first introduced me to the bone bed in my early years of graduate school. He was more interested in its fossil sea turtles. Eventually, I focused on figuring out the precise age of the bone bed and how this kind of dense rock unit full of bone nuggets and occasional skeletal parts came to be. Context is everything, and without it, answers to the bigger ecological questions about the past are undecipherable. The bone bed was essentially an exposed seafloor for several hundred thousand years, collecting the hard part remnants of Miocene whales, sea turtles, sharks, and other animals that fell to the seafloor while lighter sediment swept past. Those few inches of bone bed today thus capture a condensed interval of time between 16 and 15 million years ago. Not much for a geologist, but a span much longer than the duration of our own species. It's also a span of time probably long enough to sample the full range of extinct whales and other backboned animals that lived in the vicinity of this part of California when the Central Valley was an embayment open to the Pacific. Knowing how many fossil whale species were around, giving them all scientific names, and understanding their evolutionary relationships is all ongoing work because there's so little skeletal material to use as a basis for a species. Kellogg used ear bones for most of his species, a puzzling move given how limited they are for species-specific identification. Such work is time-consuming and exacting, measuring and comparing scraps of bone to one another. Many times we're simply left saying, this is something new, and it deserves a name, but we can't say more until someone finds a good skull. Kellogg wrapped up his Sharktooth Hill work after finishing his dissertation and secured an appointment at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., where he turned his attention to fossil whales that were more complete from an earlier time in whale evolutionary history. By the 1930s, the Smithsonian possessed the world's most extensive collection of early whales, but they weren't the land-dwelling ones, such as Pakicetus, whose skeleton still wouldn't be found for another half century. Instead, there were drawers and drawers of Basilosaurus and other species of the first fully aquatic whales, more than enough to mount full skeletons for exhibit halls, and sufficient to know something about what these extinct whales were like. Basilosaurus hardly seems like a whale. Saying it's almost like a whale would be charitable. It had a toothy, snout-dominated head, looking something like a gigantic leopard seal, except its nostrils were located not at the tip of its snout, but about halfway farther back. It had a visible neck, unlike most of today's whales. While its fingers and hands were probably encased in flesh, forming a paddle, it could bend its arms at the elbow, as no living whale can. The most remarkable thing about it was its long eel-like body. Most of its length came from its tail. Basilosaurus probably had a tail fluke, but it also had cartoonishly small hind limbs. These hind limbs were vestiges from its land-dwelling predecessors. As mentioned previously, they could not have held up Basilosaurus's enormous weight, about 6 tons, on land. In other words, Basilosaurus was fully aquatic, living its entire life underwater. Kellogg knew only a little about those tiny hind limbs. The collections at the Smithsonian, for all their depth, still comprised only a pelvis and a single femur. Did Basilosaurus have feet, toes? The answers to those questions eventually came from Basilosaurus skeletons in Egypt, a world away from the coastal plain of the United States, and many years after Kellogg died. Since the 19th century, paleontologists have known that the same strata used to build the pyramids of ancient Egypt harbor marine fossils, including fossil whales. These fossil-rich rocks crop out for nearly 100 miles to the southwest of Cairo, exposed at their grandest scale in a place called Wadi al-Hitan, loosely translated as Valley of the Whales, in the Fayum Depression. Toward the end of the 20th century, more detailed work in the area produced a species list, including 10 different early whales, along with early sea cows, primates, and the earliest elephant relatives. Wadi al-Hitan, however, earned its name because of the fossil whales, especially Basilosaurus, whose skeletons number in the hundreds, spread across miles of desert expanse, edged by cliffs and wind-battered mesas. These skeletons come from bone beds, just in a different mode from Sharktooth Hill. Over 300 skeletons of early whales are littered across 100 square miles, including the first complete Basilosaurus skeletons ever found, with skulls, arms, rib cages and tail vertebrae, and legs, everything down to the 4 tiny toes intact. What these legs might have done in life, beyond being mere vestiges, remains unclear. Some scientists have speculated that these small legs might have been used for copulation, especially given the animal's extreme snakiness. Complete skeletons of Basilosaurus give us plenty of clues about its behavior. Like some of its predecessors, Basilosaurus had acoustically isolated inner ears, letting it hear directionally underwater, but it lacked the anatomical space to house any kind of echolocation organ on its face. Basilosaurus, therefore, heard only low-frequency sounds, not the ultrasonic ones that echolocating toothed whales use today. It ate fish based on fossilized stomach contents. Every tooth in the head of Basilosaurus was capable of crushing bone, and its overall bite force exceeded that of any other mammal, living or extinct, including hyenas. Bite marks on the skulls of other smaller species of early whale from the Fayum suggest that Basilosaurus ate other whales, the way killer whales do today. One major difference with killer whales? Basilosaurus could crush its food, whereas killer whales rip and tear, oftentimes working together. At the moment, we can't say whether Basilosaurus moved about in pods. There's no good fossil correlate for that kind of behavior. The fossil-rich rocks of Wadi al-Hitan reflect ancient shorelines formed during episodes of periodic sea-level rise and fall at the end of the Eocene, around 40 to 35 million years ago. Basilosaurus probably inhabited these lagoonal environments. It certainly was buried in them. It lived not unlike many dolphins do today, ranging from coastal shores to open water. By the time Basilosaurus went extinct, at the end of the Eocene, subsequent branches in the whale family tree leading to today's whales had already evolved. While we don't have a good fossil record for the very beginning of today's echolocating and filter-feeding whales, we suspect they looked a fair bit like Basilosaurus. Fully aquatic, though less snaky, sized-down shadows of the leviathans they would later become, tens of millions of years later. So much for the hows of fossil whales with legs. But why? What led whales to return to the water from land in the first place? That question takes us to the gap between the first and the second phases of whale evolution, the gap that remains in the family tree between the branches leading to Myocetus and Basilosaurus. In about 10 million years, whales went from looking like the four-legged Pachycetus to something closer to Basilosaurus. Sometime during that interval, and probably in the last half of it, whales ambled and swam equal amounts, with shorter hind limbs and blowholes migrating backward along their snouts. And then, at some point, a generation of whales never emerged out of the water back onto land, and their descendants begat blue whales, humpbacks, sperm whales, and every other living whale species, along with many extinct ones, like Kellogg's finds from the Miocene. The search for true causes, especially in the evolutionary sciences, is not usually as conclusive as the search for patterns and their data. Hows are much more forthcoming than whys. For whale origins, multiple explanations for their reentrance abound. They return to escape predators on land, to take advantage of more prey at sea, to seize new habitats unexploited by any major marine predator since the demise of gigantic marine reptiles at the end of the Cretaceous, about 20 million years prior. Each one of these explanations is plausible, but difficult to test. Maybe one day we'll refine those explanations into a hypothesis with a prediction that we can evaluate, perhaps using the geologic context of these early whales, comparisons of their osteology with those of marine reptiles, or a novel analytical tool. One thing for sure, we will definitely benefit from more fossils, so we should keep looking. Every scrap of fossilized bone found in the field may be novel, but they're not all precious. There's always some decision-making about whether any particular fossil should be collected in the first place. It is really all about the questions at hand and how any certain fossil find can help answer it. Bone beds are like caches of evidence, areas rich with clues, either because of the density of remains contained within them, as at Sharptooth Hill, or because of the completeness of the specimens in a given space, as at Wadi al-Hitan. One fossil find can tell us about that individual, but it also contained a snapshot of real ecological interaction, lost in geologic time. That's an important detail from life in the distant geologic past, especially when we want to know the details of not merely the anatomy or evolutionary relationships of extinct organisms, but the food webs and ecosystems in which they lived millions of years ago. Finding these kinds of paleontological caches is thrilling. And it can also be overwhelming, as I would soon find out for myself. Chapter 4, Time Travel on the Fossil Whale Highway. Imagine floating above the great tapered tail of South America from space, seeing it stripped of clouds, ice, soil, and water, so that the geologic world beneath is made visible. The familiar outline of the continent rises in stark, jagged relief. The high spine of the Andes is draped in red and gray bands to the east, toward Argentina, and ochres and sands cover Chile to the west. From this vantage, the cone of South America is locked in by a jigsaw puzzle of oceanic plates, and a surprisingly deep, dark cut mars its western boundary. This incision marks the border between the Nazca and South American tectonic plates, where the lip of the former inexorably and slowly rolls under the edge of the latter. This action uplifts what was once seafloor, carrying ancient organisms buried in it, extinct whales included, slowly to dry land on the western edge of South America. This tectonic motion, called subduction, eventually yields mountain chains like the Andes over geologic time. But at the scale of human lifetimes, subduction can cause megathrust earthquakes that convulse entire cities, maroon fishing boats, and kill thousands in a span of seconds. In 1835, a young Charles Darwin observed the outcome of this very process along the coast of Chile, near Concepcion. 3 years into its round-the-world voyage, the HMS Beagle had rounded the horn of Tierra del Fuego and made its way up the west coast of South America. Darwin was ashore when the earthquake started, A crescendo over the course of hours allowed most of the residents of Concepcion to flee and limited the scope of fatalities to a few dozen people. Aftershocks rattled, terrified locals for several days thereafter. Darwin later surveyed the devastation in Concepcion firsthand, noting that most of the city was flattened, burned, or flooded by an accompanying tsunami, and that the entire shoreline of the harbor had risen several feet, stranding limpets and starfish. Darwin surmised that these catastrophic effects were connected with the volcanic eruptions he had observed during earlier forays hundreds of miles south near Chiloé. Darwin suspected that volcanic eruptions, the sudden uplift of coastlines, earthquakes, and tsunamis were linked by a common underlying mechanism. His intuitive guess was more right than he could have known. They were all consequences of subduction, the jerky slippage of great masses of tectonic plates against one another, and the central process that underpins the idea of plate tectonics. Plate tectonics is a very young idea about how the Earth works. Until the late 20th century, geology textbooks did not have a clear answer for why South America's eastern edge fits so nicely with the west coast of Africa, which is a bit like launching moon-bound rockets without knowing Newton's physics. Eventually, scientists discovered that the convection currents from deep inside the Earth drive the fragmented crust of the Earth's rocky surface into constant motion over geologic time. Every continent and the ocean plates between them floats on a vast, molten, and churning globe. The idea of plate tectonics also neatly explains a variety of patterns in the fossil record, including why so many plants and extinct animals across the southern continents look so similar, namely because they were once, 100 million years ago, living together on a larger continental mass that has since broken apart. Before he started thinking about evolution, Darwin was a geologist, one with a long view of history and the planet. Deep time was a new idea when Darwin roamed the South American cone. What he saw there, the earthquake at Concepcion, petrified forests in the high Andes, and fossils of extinct land mammals in Patagonia, resonated with the concept of an unfathomably old planet, one that had actually weathered many billions of years, time enough for the power of selection to yield finches, tortoises, and whales. Darwin spent his last days in South America on horseback in the Atacama Desert of Chile, geologizing away at any exposure of inner Earth while en route to meeting the Beagle, which was moored along the northern coast near the town of Caldera. From there, he headed north and westward by sea, eventually to the Galapagos Islands. Textbooks celebrate Darwin's few weeks on the Galapagos, but tend to minimize the fact that he spent 2 years in the South American cone. He never returned to Chile, but his social network continued the work he had begun. Correspondences born out of a shared love for the land and scientific questions about it roused a generation of Europeans who decamped for its rugged, open landscapes. The result is a testament to the strength of friendships that can transcend generations. They established the first centers of learning in Chile, including a national museum whose collections still hold fossils that Darwin collected over 180 years ago. When you open up museum drawers and handle those specimens, you realize that these physical objects connect scientists across centuries, anchoring the questions that we have about evolution on this planet. Sweeping offshore the Atacama is the Humboldt Current, an enormous, ever-flowing body of water that cannot be discerned by the naked eye. Its namesake is a scientific figure of impressive breadth and accomplishment who preceded Darwin by decades, although Alexander von Humboldt never made it south of Lima, Peru. Today, the Humboldt Current is renowned as one of the richest fisheries on the planet. Open any can of anchovies or sardines, and there's a good chance that its contents came from the ocean current that stretches from Chilean Patagonia to Peru and the Galapagos. Understanding how the Humboldt Current works, in the simplest terms, requires a step back to look at the coastal phenomenon of upwelling. When the Earth spins on its tilted axis, hot air rolls unevenly off the continents and transforms into trade winds over open ocean. These winds push hot water away from coastlines, and in its place arise enormous spirals of nutrient-rich water from the ocean's depths in a process called upwelling. Westerly coastlines across the world, from California to Chile to Angola, all share the right set of geographic features for this process. Upwelling forms the foundation for rich and productive ocean food webs because of the nutrients brought up from the deep. Ocean water at the surface generally has enough oxygen, but it's upwelling that carries nitrogen and phosphorus into shallower waters and enriches them by fertilizing both light-fixing phytoplankton and their consumers, zooplankton. The oceans may be vast, but upwelling creates specific places where these tiny organisms gather. Where there's food to eat, that's where whales, sardines, and penguins all want to be. And if you're a whale paleontologist, you want to be on the coast nearby, where upwelling and subduction combine in a perfect way. Upwelling gives us whales, and ultimately their remains, whale bones, to look for, while subduction uplifts ancient seafloors to dry land. Along with these two processes, the accident of the Atacama's latitude makes the entire desert a gift for scientists seeking rocks. It's devoid of grass, trees, and the blacktop of civilization. Arid and exposed badlands allow erosion to exhume the remains of ancient whales locked in a rock without the interference of soil or tree roots. Erosion helps, but paleontologists also have to find the right kind of rocks. Of the three categories, igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary, for fossil whales, only sedimentary rocks will do. Whales don't preserve well in volcanic lava flows, and fossils hardly ever survive the tremendous heat and pressure that creates metamorphic rocks dozens of miles beneath the Earth's surface. Among the array of sedimentary rocks, the most promising ones include mudstones, representing offshore seafloors, and sandstones, representing nearshore ones. Thanks to uplift, the only way to find fossils in the Atacama involves rolling across washes and mesas by foot or truck, finding these rocks and keeping an eye out for a glint of bone. Whale bones tend to be relatively big, after all. Since Darwin's time, many thousands of bits of bone and teeth have been collected from the Caldera Basin, some ending up in natural history museums such as the one in Santiago, founded by Darwin's correspondence. Fossil collections from Caldera consist almost entirely of fragments of skulls, limb bones, and teeth, never complete skeletons. But the little they show suggests the humble current of the past was different. Familiar species such as whales, sharks, and sea turtles lived alongside bizarre extinct ones, including nightmarish bony-toothed seabirds, long-snouted aquatic sloths, and school bus-sized predatory sharks. When I first started to contemplate working in the Atacama, the problem was that we didn't have precise ages on all of these fossils in hand. We needed one complete chronicle of rocks in the Caldera Basin. Minimally, we needed to identify the correct succession of layers these fossils came from, identifying oldest to youngest. At best, we hoped to pin down the ages of each fossil-bearing layer with numerical geologic dates. Once that context was arranged, we would be able to chart the rise and fall of each species over millions of years against the backdrop of broader changes to ocean temperature, sea level, and circulation. Wear a geologist's hat, find whale bones, and figure out the story of how the Humboldt Current's ecosystem came to be. After years of planning, correspondence, and false starts, I found myself sweating in the glare of the Atacama sun. I paused from scanning a geologic map of the Caldera Basin, spread across the hood of the Toyota pickup, and squinted, hoping to catch a glimpse of people summiting the flat top of a mesa in the distance. The harshness of the white light pinched my vision, split between the patchwork of colors on the map before me and the pale blue dome above my head. I was frustrated, my mind elsewhere. We were late. The students on the field team hadn't reconvened at the agreed-to time, and we needed to keep moving. We had followed the whalebone trail in the Atacama, and that trail led us straight into fault lines, many of them. Finding fossils wasn't exactly our problem. Instead, it was their context. We were having a difficult time piecing together the succession of rock layers in which we were finding them. As tectonic processes uplifted ancient seafloors, they also broke them up, like a layer cake dropped on the floor. Consequently, deciphering the specific old-to-young sequence of layer upon layer of rock was complicated by long vertical fractures that displace the layers up and down relative to one another. We tend to think of geologic faults as stretching across hundreds of miles, and that's certainly true for some of them. But they also manifest locally in a rock outcrop that may be no broader than the side of a house. In the Caldera Basin, faulting sometimes created a jumbled layer of rock rather than a neat stack. With boots on the ground, building a single chronology of rocks meant finding specific places where we could measure the thickness of the rock layer in a repeatable way using a simple geologic tool called a Jacob's staff. We would also note the composition, color, and texture of each rock layer. Occasionally, we would also hammer out a sample of the most promising rocks, usually the ashes, in the hope of finding tiny volcanic grains that would yield precise geologic dates back in a laboratory. Through this slow, exacting work of measuring, describing, and sampling, we hope to pin down actual dates in geologic time for enough layers in the sequence to understand the succession of different extinct species, whales and otherwise, that once lived in the Humboldt Current. Back at the truck, however, I wasn't thinking about geologic maps or envisioning layers of fossil whales captured through time. Instead, I was thinking about hours wasted miles away from the air-conditioned convenience and sprawling desk work within my museum's walls. I thought about all the effort and time, coordinating airfares and truck rentals, pushing permits along, accounting for family and professional commitments. As the students crested the mesa, I waved at them. What I really wanted to do was slam on the truck's horn until it was out of air. Carolina Gutstein, my friend and colleague, then finishing her doctoral degree, stood with me at the truck. "You know, you can't just rush people," she leveled, without hesitation, sizing up my agitation like a sibling. "Trying to make things go faster here is only going to make them go a lot slower." I laughed ever so slightly, but stopped when I turned to look at her. Carol's face was dispassionately still, her mountaineering sunglasses reflecting a stereo double of my own wary glance. I looked down in frustration, back towards the map on the hood, and exhaled. When I glanced her way again, she smiled, breaking the tension. "Why don't we go see all those whales at Cerro Baena?" she offered. "I'll call Tuareg to show us around. He and Jim are over there now. You're not going to believe it." Actually, I thought I had good reason not to believe it, especially to involve the man who calls himself Tuareg. His real name is Mario Suarez, and he's probably the single best fossil finder I've ever known. He demurs when asked, but Mario's self-appointed nickname is clearly meant to evoke the stoic Berber people of the Sahara, an image he routinely betrays by losing his cell phone, he's lost more than a dozen, and completely going AWOL when needed, usually found at the nearest bakery. But at the time, we were strictly in his domain, working under his collecting permit, which he held as curator at the local paleontology museum in the town of Caldera. Tuareg had emailed me earlier that year about a place he started to call Cerro Baena, where he said complete whale skeletons had been found, but I had a hard time discerning much from afar. I remembered having seen the site on a past visit, a sloping road cut of the Pan-American Highway that trenched through a layer cake of orange and tan marine rocks. The only fossils I had noted were a smattering of skull bones from a large whale, likely a baleen one. Locals had tried tunneling out the bones, unsuccessfully, next to graffiti carved in the soft sandstone. None too auspicious. Fossil whale skulls are sometimes a jumble of broken bones that hardly make sense at the rock outcrop, and require care and study back at a laboratory. Also, they almost always involve heavy logistics that simply outstripped our time, our resources, and to be frank, my motivation. Caro's suggestion reminded me of that whale skull we had seen together by the side of the road, although I was only burdened by the recollection to a point. If we had more time, maybe we could collect it, but we had to make hard decisions on the use of our time. We were in the Atacama to understand the evolution of the Humboldt Current ecosystem, as read from layers of fossils from dozens of species across time. Doing so offered the chance to find out much more than a single broken-up baleen whale skull could ever tell us. Constructing a single stratigraphic column from the stacks of rocks across miles of fractured desert terrain was something reasonable and feasible to achieve during a single field season, if not particularly sexy. I was also on the hook to deliver publications out of our work as a foundation for future collaborations. As it turned out, I had no clue how wrong I was about the importance of that broken-up skull at the side of the road, nor a hint about the scope of what it represented. If I was ambivalent about seeing Tuareg, at least I was buoyed by the thought of reuniting with Jim Parham. Jim is a like-minded scientist, a friend, and a terrific sounding board. His finely tuned bullshit detector always checked my field decisions about logistics. Earlier that day, we had split the field team in two to maximize our time. Caro and I took the students to the south, while Jim and Tuareg went north to Cerro Baena. "I really don't think we both should be in the same truck as Tuareg," I said to Jim at breakfast. "Oh, just as a matter of sanity," he assented. When Jim, Caro, and I had visited Cerro Baena with Tuareg several years earlier, we'd referred to its location as that road cut next to Playa del Pulpos, taken from the nearest highway sign. By late 2010, it had become Cerro Baena, literally Whale Hill in Spanish, if only because of global geopolitics in this dusty part of the Atacama. In the past few decades, Chile's geologic resources have become prized targets for extraction by the mining industry, and accommodating large mining machines has meant road widening along remote parts of the Pan American Highway. An environmental impact study at Cerro Baena concluded that further expansion would very likely uncover more fossils. Nevertheless, a road construction company was green-lighted to begin widening the highway. To comply, the company enlisted Tuareg and his museum for assistance, with Chile's strong natural patrimony laws ensuring that any fossils would be saved. It was then that Tuareg started sending me clipped emails and shaky videos from the site, not exactly adequately conveying the message of what was happening there. Besides, it was Tuareg. Hard to pull out the facts from hyperbole. When Caro and I arrived, Tuareg and Jim were pacing about the quarry. Large black felt tarps dotted the desert floor every dozen feet, stretching north and south. I ambled up to Jim. "Dude," he said in a low voice, telling me everything I needed to know in a single word. "This is not the Playa del Pulpos that we saw 2 years ago." Everyone gathered to follow as Tuareg walked from tarp to tarp, rolling each one backward. My mouth fell open as I absorbed the fact that every tarp covered at least one complete whale skeleton, and sometimes several on top of one another. Every black tarp, dozens spread up and down the road-cut quarry, demarcated a whale skeleton. The sheer density of complete skeletons outstripped everything I thought that I knew about how whales get preserved as fossils. The skeletons, some 30 feet long, were almost all complete in a way that fossil whales hardly ever are, nose to tail. Many looked as if the creature had died in place, carefully turned on its back, and then been pressed flat over geologic time, like a preserved flower. Skulls were easy to spot, their triangular projections and bowed jawbones at the end of a trail of brick-like vertebrae. Rib cages collapsed toward tails like gigantic slinkies. In many skeletons, the ribs were still adorned with shoulder blades connected to arms and even finger bones. The fossil whales at this site were jaw-droppingly complete, and it made no sense that there were so many so close together. I couldn't think of any other field site of fossil whales like it. I was stunned. Tuareg gabbed away with a positively gleeful Caro and her students. I walked over to where Jim stood at the south end of the quarry, taking photos and rubbing sediment between his fingers. We silently watched the sun slipping over the horizon, evening cloud banks bringing a cool wind. In the distance, a single round peak, El Moro, a weathered mound of igneous rock, capped the view. "It's over," Jim said flatly. I looked north and south across the entire quarry, more than a football field in length. I knew exactly what he meant. Anything we had thought about doing needed to make room for this site and the several dozen skeletons that stretched up and down the hill in each direction. Measuring the stratigraphic columns across the caldera basin, slotting in all the fossils we already knew about, deciphering that geologic map full of faults, it all needed to wait. My hours and hours of planning had focused on a sure thing, returning with bags of rock samples and with notebooks full of the makings of promise papers. Entire whale skeletons were not part of that plan, certainly not dozens of them. I breathed in anxious and unsure. I was frustrated with myself for not listening to Tuareg more carefully earlier on, paralyzed by the enormity of the scene in front of me. At the same time, part of me recognized that the scope of the site, with its dozens of perfect whale skeletons, was undeniably significant. And I had an open invitation to be one of the first ones to study a place like nowhere else, as far as I knew, on the planet. It was vexing and tantalizing. It was a kind of Pandora's box, and we'd just seen it crack open. "I know," I said. "What are we going to do?" Chapter 5. The Afterlife of a Whale. I think a lot about how whales die. That might sound like the ranting of a whalebone chaser gone full Ahab. But my preoccupation is not with the gore of decaying flesh or exploding body cavities, although those don't really bother me. Instead, I'm fascinated by the details of the what, where, how, and why. What happens to their carcasses, their locations when they expire, how whales perish, and the reasons for their demise. You might think that these facts are easily uncovered in the scientific literature or in the many accounts of whaling on the high seas. But they aren't, not for all of the whales that have washed up on the world's shores or been hauled up by whalers. So I parse these factors in my head instead. Ocean currents, water depth and temperature, scavengers, time to burial, and even anatomical differences that contribute to the many different ways that a whale carcass might become a fossil. Figuring out what parts of the living world can be entombed in rock and how we might find them is a game of probabilities. Paleontologists tend to think about the life and death of organisms as a continuous thread from birth to death and to museum drawer. We visualize this thread as a stream of information where a variety of biological and physical processes winnow away data at each step in a pathway of decay. A carcass scavenged to pieces, not buried intact. A skeleton or parts thereof coming to rest in an unpromising setting. The rocks containing the fossil accidentally destroyed. Even if a great specimen is uncovered, the fossils may lie silently in a museum, collected from the field but mislabeled or undiscovered in a drawer. The reality is that we lose information throughout this process. It's an attrition of data from carcass to cabinet. Given the chances against any living thing becoming a fossil, it is a wonder that we know anything about life from the geologic past at all. Thinking like a paleontologist makes you something of a connoisseur of dead things. My pursuit of dead whales has led to the rich record of strandings. Since antiquity, whale strandings have captivated the interest of everyone, from Aristotle to casual spectators of exploding whale videos on YouTube. Strandings are a timeless motif, an immobilized beach-cast leviathan angrily tail-slapping against the surf. The image shocks us because we imagine whales to be fully a part of the aquatic realm. How would a whale end up landlocked in our world, a creature so large and strange, suddenly so uniquely vulnerable? Whale strandings happen in many different ways, for multiple reasons. Consequently, there is no single definition of a stranding, just an operational one, for the seemingly aberrant sight of a whale on a shoreline. For example, a stranding might consist of one whale, a mother calf pair, several individuals from a single species, or several individuals from different species. Adding to the complexity is how they strand. Whales may be dead upon arrival, alive but flailing on the shore, or already decayed to a raft of blubber, cartilage, and bones. Beyond the how, there is more complexity to the why. What causes a whale stranding? Senescence or disease may provide simple explanations in some cases, whereas the side effects of living near humans can be either plainly obvious, entanglement in fishing nets or ropes, or more difficult to plumb, toxin poisoning from marine algae. Certainly the sight of an entire pod of whales stranded, dozens in a row, begs some kind of explanation, although that is frequently elusive. True cause is often like that in the natural world. For naturalists working before the era of Yankee whaling, in the mid-19th century, strandings provided the only source of anatomical knowledge about whales. Despite all of the whales killed by Basque whalers for hundreds of years in Europe, there was essentially no documentation of what a whale looked like on the inside. Fairly important evidence when you consider that despite a few snout hairs, nipples, and nostrils for breathing air, whales otherwise largely look like fish on the outside. There are